Good afternoon. My name is Susan Muirhead, and today I'll be reading part one of the News Gazette, dated for this date, Tuesday, October 6th, 2020. As always, we begin with today's headlines. The first headline reads, Election 2020, Illinois' 13th congressional district. Davis Londrigan spar over health care. This article is written by Ben Zigderman and is based out of Champaign. Much like during their race 2 years ago to represent Illinois' 13th congressional district, Democrat Betsy Dirksen Londrigan and Republican incumbent Rodney Davis spent much of Monday's debate sparring over health care. Londrigan repeatedly attacked Davis for voting to repeal the Affordable Care Act without a replacement lined up, while Davis pointed to his vote on a GOP plan that didn't pass in the U.S. Senate. He voted 11 times to repeal the Affordable Care Act with no replacement, Londrigan said. It would have gutted protections for people with pre-existing conditions. It risked shuttering rural hospitals and taking away every essential health benefit that we all count on. Davis insisted the health care plan he supported, the one vote that counted, would have protected the coverage of those with pre-existing conditions, citing his wife's battle with cancer. "This is personal for me and my family," he said. "My wife has a genetic form of cancer that could affect my kids. There's absolutely no way that I'm going to support a plan that's not going to include pre-existing conditions coverage." But fact-checkers concluded in 2018 that while the Republican plan wouldn't have allowed coverage to be denied based on pre-existing conditions, it could have resulted in unaffordable costs for them. Londrigan also criticized Davis for voting no 3 times on Democratic resolutions against a lawsuit before the Supreme Court that could strike down the Affordable Care Act. Davis said he doesn't support the lawsuit and that one of those votes was part of a U.S. House of Representatives rules package with plenty of rules that I disagree with, and I voted no. And he criticized Londrigan's support of a public government-run health care option. He said her plan would close up to 39 rural hospitals in central Illinois, citing a study from a hospital and insurance trade group. Londrigan said she would only support a bill by working in concert with the hospitals to make sure that they can maintain their excellent standard of care that can help drive down costs. The race is expected to be close, much like it was in 2018, when Davis defeated Londrigan by less than a percentage point. The candidates were also asked about Roe versus Wade. While Davis said he's pro-life, he didn't want to dwell on the issue. "We need to not just talk about issues that divide us," he said. And he said that, "I don't believe government should be in charge of our health care." "That should be qualified with, unless you have a uterus," Londrigan responded, because then he seems to be fine with the government telling women what to do with their bodies. Londrigan said she trusts women to make their own decisions about their own bodies without the government interfering in those very personal medical decisions. Londrigan also criticized the Trump administration for its handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. "He knew it was airborne, and he lied to the American public about it repeatedly, and there was no national plan," she said. "We have to do better." Davis didn't directly address President Donald Trump's role, but said there's lots of blame to go around from Republicans and Democrats. The next headline reads, Illinois impact. Champaign County surpasses 5,000 confirmed cases, mourns death of 24th resident. A woman in her 90s with underlying health conditions became the 24th Champaign County resident and fourth in 6 days to lose their life to COVID-19, CU Public Health District Administrator Julie Pride said. Illinois' 10th most populous county, Champaign, became the 9th to surpass 5,000 cases when it added 62 on Monday. The lone county in the top 10 in population yet to reach that mark should soon, and that's McHenry, with 4,817 cases. There was no change Monday to the number of Champaign County residents hospitalized with COVID-19, 6. But two other metrics were up: 7-day positivity rate, 0.5 to 0.6%, and recovered cases by 47 to 4,605. Active cases rose by 15 to 375. The zip codes with the most are zip code 61820 out of Champaign with 206 cases. That's the same. There's no up or down. There's no new cases to report this week. Out of 61801, Urbana, 39 cases, up 1. 61821, Champaign zip code, 35 cases. That's up 7. 61822, Champaign, 18 cases. That's down 7. 61853, Mahomet, 18 cases. That's down by 1. Two toddlers were among 28 new positive tests in Vermilion County, where 170 active cases include 7 hospitalizations. Ford County also reported 2 hospitalized residents. And those facts are brought to us by Jeff D'Alessio of the News Gazette. The next headline reads, top of the morning. Something to get you going today, courtesy of Vice President Jim Rosso. Area groups doing good things. The Rotary Club of Champaign's first End Polio Now button campaign is up and running ahead of World Polio Day on October 24th. The club's Janet Ellis Nelson visited Monday to remind that every donation made will be matched 2-1 by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. We are very grateful to them for their partnership and support, Nelson said. Donations can be dropped off at the News Gazette. Address is 201 Devonshire Drive, Champaign, or mail to Champaign Rotary at 1222 Lancaster Drive, Champaign, Illinois, 61821. Donors who contribute at least $20 will receive an End Polio Now button. Rotary for years has raised money and awareness in the fight against polio, but have relied almost exclusively on donations from its own members, she said. Reach out to Rotary at Champaign IL, that's Champaign IL, Rotary, Rotary, at gmail.com with questions. So that's their email address if you wish to reach out to them. For the 10th year, the Champaign-Urbana Elks Lodge and Urbana Police Lodge 70 are collecting money to buy winter coats for children in need. The lodge at 903 North Dunlap Avenue will accept monetary donations from 3 to 8 p.m. Tuesday through Sunday until October 30th, highlighted by a collection day effort from 9 a.m. to noon on October 23rd, outside behind Old Orchard Lanes. Also, checks made out to CU Elks can be mailed to 903 North Dunlap Avenue, Savoy, Illinois, 61874. You can reach out to Mary Lemming, and her phone number is 217-493-6026 with questions. The next headline reads, corrections. The News Gazette strives to present fair and accurate reporting and to correct any errors as promptly as possible. Corrections and clarifications for all sections run on this page. To report an error, please call 217-351-5252, then press 6 to reach the newsroom. The next headline reads, Area History. In 1920, a $7,500, that's $98,000 in today's dollars, orchestral pipe organ of a type unequaled in the Twin Cities was installed at Urbana's Colonial Theater and was to make its debut. In 1970, the Urbana City Council discussed allowing packaged liquor stores to be open and taverns to operate on Sundays. Alderman Jack Hensler said he felt that with liquor being sold just 150 yards outside the city at the Sunny Crest Shopping Center, Urbana was losing too much revenue. In 2005, contract talks with Champaign teachers stalled and the two sides called for a mediator. Champaign Federation of Teachers President Greg Novak said a meeting set for October 12th at Centennial High School where members would take an intent to strike vote, was definitely on, quote unquote. No more negotiating sessions were scheduled because of the mediation process. In international history, today's highlight, on October 6, 1973, war erupted in the Middle East as Egypt and Syria launched a surprise attack on Israel during the Yom Kippur holiday. Israel, initially caught off guard, pushed back the Arab forces before a ceasefire finally took hold in the nearly three-week conflict. On this date, in 1884, the Naval War College was established in Newport, Rhode Island. In 1927, Talking Pictures arrived with the opening of The Jazz Singer, starring Al Jolson, a feature containing silent and sound synchronized sequences. In 1939, in a speech to the Reichstag, German Chancellor Adolf Hitler spoke of his plans to reorder the ethnic layout of Europe, a plan which would entail settling the Jewish problem, quote-unquote. In 1949, President Harry S. Truman signed the Mutual Defense Assistance Act, providing $1.3 billion in military aid to NATO countries. And in 1969, the New York Mets won the first ever National League Championship Series, defeating the Atlanta Braves 7-4. In Game 3, the Baltimore Orioles won the first ever American League Championship Series, defeating the Minnesota Twins 11-2 in Game 3. The next headline reads, Election 2020. Pence takes lead on campaign trail with Trump sidelined. This article is written by Brian Slotisko and is written for the Associated Press and is based out of Washington. With President Donald Trump ill with COVID-19, Vice President Mike Pence took the lead role in campaigning Monday, starting a swing through key states to bolster the president's chance for re-election. Trump left Walter Reed Military Medical Center and returned to the White House Monday evening, but it's unclear when he'll be able to travel. I spoke to the president a little while back. He sounded great, Pence told reporters at Joint Base Andrews before heading west to Utah for this week's vice presidential debate. When the president told me that he was headed back to the White House, he told me to head to Utah, and we're looking very much forward to the vice presidential debate, he said. The stakes in this election have never been higher, and the choice has never been clearer. Pence wants to keep the president's supporters energized and deflect criticism of the administration's handling of a virus that has killed more than 205,000 Americans. Trump's positive diagnosis Friday has intensified scrutiny of the administration's cavalier approach to the pandemic. The spotlight on Pence will be especially bright Wednesday when he participates in the vice presidential debate with California Senator Kamala Harris. Pence will almost certainly be pressed to explain shifting accounts of the president's health over the weekend and justify Trump's decision to hold large in-person campaign rallies during a pandemic, events that often flouted public health guidelines by congregating thousands of mostly maskless supporters. Normally, the vice presidential debate is inconsequential. That is not the case in 2020, said Alex Conant, a Republican strategist who worked on Florida Senator Marco Rubio's 2016 presidential bid. The public has so many questions about how we got here, and it's an opportunity for Pence to answer some of those. Pence has often been called upon to smooth over fallout from Trump's messy decision-making and divisive policies. Since the 2016 campaign, he has served as a bridge of sorts between a brash, thrice-married former reality television star who long bragged about womanizing, and the more traditional branch of the Republican Party, particularly conservative evangelicals. The smooth diction and humble demeanor Pence brings to the role was honed in the 1990s as a conservative talk radio host in Indiana when he referred to himself as Rush Limbaugh on Decaf. His approach hasn't always been successful. As Indiana's governor from 2013 to 2017, he was so relentlessly on message that he sometimes struggled to contain fallout from fast-moving crises. That includes his handling of backlash over a 2015 law he signed that allowed business owners to deny service to gay people for religious reasons, which was later amended as a result of the uproar. During an interview with George Stephanopoulos on ABC when he was governor, Pence grew flustered after failing to answer direct questions about whether discrimination against gay people should be legal. "George," Pence protested before letting out an audible sigh. "Come on." The debate with Harris will be a major test. The former California prosecutor's political rise was fueled by searing exchanges with political rivals during major congressional hearings. And she is certain to press the issue of the virus and Trump's diagnoses when the two meet in Salt Lake City. "That will be his challenge, but it is one he is well suited for," said Cam Savage, a veteran Republican strategist from Indiana who has closely observed Pence's political career. With Pence, you get a very disciplined leader who is not likely to make mistakes. One major uncertainty is what sort of condition Trump will be in during the weeks ahead. His administration has offered rosy assessments of his health, but Trump's blood oxygen level abruptly dropped twice in recent days, and he was given supplemental oxygen before his hospitalization. There are also concerns that Pence could himself catch the virus while campaigning, a troubling scenario that raises serious questions about national security and the transfer of power if either he or Trump took a turn for the worse. After the debate, Pence says, "It's back to business as usual, and the campaign has appearances planned for him, as well as Trump's children and other top surrogates, in an effort billed as Operation MAGA." Pence is slated to visit Arizona and Florida and will return to Indiana on Friday to vote early. "We've got a campaign to run," Pence said Saturday on a call with staff. "I promise you, this president, as soon as his doctors say so, he's going to be back out there." Pence often evokes faith when describing his approach to public office, citing the biblical concept of servant leadership. He has been a faithful servant to Trump since he was plucked from a difficult bid for re-election as governor to join the presidential ticket in 2016. Though Pence has long held presidential ambitions, his own political career was on the ropes. The former congressman turned governor had a dismal approval rating. His enthusiastic support for religious conservative cultural issues alienated moderate Republicans and drew threats of boycott of the state. And he faced a difficult re-election battle against the same Democrat that he narrowly beat in 2012. His selection for the Trump ticket removed him from a lackluster campaign that leaned heavily on car racing metaphors that often fell flat, even though the state has a deep affinity for the sport and is home to the Indianapolis 500. As Trump's envoy to religious conservatives, Pence quickly revitalized his political prospects. Often referencing the Supreme Court, Pence reminded fellow religious conservatives that the future makeup of the judiciary would be determined by the 2016 winner, a prediction poised to become reality with Trump's nomination of Amy Coney Barrett to replace liberal icon Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The next headline reads, "Tuskegee Airmen, quite an outfit." Air Force's uniforms, street discussion show airmen not just the pride of Rantoul. This article is written by Dave Hinton and is based out of Rantoul. Champaign County entry points have signs proclaiming it as the birthplace of the Tuskegee Airmen in March of 1941. A sign along Interstate 57 at Rantoul bears a sign for the Tuskegee Airmen Trail. Rantoul, former home of Chanute Air Force Base is proud of its connection to the airmen. Were it not for segregation, they might be known as the Chanute Airmen. America has awakened to the role of the airmen. The latest example came Saturday when members of the Air Force football team donned uniforms of gray with black lettering and a yellow stripe on each shoulder that they wore in their 40-7 sinking of Navy in the Falcons season opener. A custom nameplate on the jerseys read Red Tails, as the fighter pilots were known for their distinctive airplanes' markings. The chrome-based helmets showed the P-51 Mustang aircraft with the signature red tails and nose, squadron patches for the 99th, 100th, 301st and 302nd were also included on the helmets. It's all part of a look back in honor of the Black aviators who played such a valuable role during World War II. The Rantoul community tries every chance it gets to remember its connection to the airmen. The first unit of the Tuskegee Airmen, the 99th Pursuit Squadron, was formed at Chanute Field to train support personnel before all operations were moved to Tuskegee, Alabama, where most of the pilots were trained. They had to create a segregated base for the Tuskegee Airmen to get the flight training, said Harold Rapier, president of the Chicago DODO chapter of the Tuskegee Airmen, Inc. Long road to acceptance. The chapter is named after the dodo, a bird of the island of the Mauritius that lost its ability to fly, because, just like the dodo, the airmen lost the ability to fly after World War II. The airmen were not allowed to fly commercial flights until nearly 20 years later. Said Rapier, in 1941, the War Department did not want the Tuskegee Airmen to fly. By 1945, only the Nazis felt the same way. Stateside, commercial aviation officials felt likewise, and it took years to overcome. Rantoul resident Walter Weathersby, who is Black, remembers how difficult it was for a Black man to gain acceptance. A Mississippi native, Weathersby was in pre-dental school at St. Louis University when he was drafted by the Army during the Korean War. He scored so high in the Army aptitude tests, in the top 4%, that he was transferred to the Air Force. But despite his high score, he wasn't given the opportunity to be a pilot or to enter some other career field. He was told he was going to be a cook and was assigned to Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas, for 12 weeks of training prior to being assigned to March AFB in Riverside, California. There was a non-written policy of the government that most of the time a minority cannot qualify for a career field, for any career field. Weathersby, a respected member of the Rantoul community, said in a 2016 story, or if they qualified, the government did not put you in a no career field. It was at Lockbourne AFB in Columbus, Ohio, the only African American Air Force base in the nation, where Weathersby was a cook for the Tuskegee Airmen. The Air Force several years later relented, and Weathersby was able to enter the supply division, where he spent 30 years. More honors on the way. The former Chanute Air Museum, hosted a large event several years ago in which a P-51 Mustang World War II era fighter was flown in, and a mobile theater told the history of the airmen. Nearly 1,000 area school children attended. A Rantoul event scheduled in March to honor the aviators was postponed due to concerns over the coronavirus. The commendation was to have included members of the Chicago Dodo chapter. Most of the chapter members are older than 60. The event was to have included a caravan heading from Chicago, escorted by state troopers to Rantoul, followed by a tour of the former Chanute Air Force Base before stopping at Lincoln's Challenge Academy. Organizers were hopeful a couple of the original Tuskegee Airmen would have been able to attend. Valerie O'Neill, recording secretary for the chapter, said it has not been determined if the event will be rescheduled. Rantoul Village Administrator Scott Eisenhower said the village is hoping it can happen. We are obviously very interested in trying to host that once restrictions are lifted to a point where a large number can gather, 100 to 200 people, he said. The village also plans to honor the airmen by renaming a street or dedicating a street in their name. There's two schools of thought of either taking an existing street or make it an honorary street, or try to identify a street with the ability to change its name without much impact to residential businesses, Eisenhower said. That was our approach, because that way it would show up on a GIS system or on a map. Eisenhower said some members of the public have called for a major thoroughfare in town to be used. That way the street name would stay the same, but it would also be named in honor of the airmen with brown signage below the street name. And there's several pictures in the paper, front page center, as this is the front headline, front page headline. So one of the pictures underneath the photograph is the caption, a sign at the Champaign County line on North Route 45 notes the area's ties to the famed Tuskegee Airmen. So there's a highway photo with a truck going down the highway, and it says Champaign County, and underneath it, that's one sign, and underneath it is another sign that says birthplace of the Tuskegee Airmen, March 1941. And there's also a small photograph, a rear view of the Red Tails uniforms the Air Force football team wore last weekend. So you, there's a picture of the back of a football player. He's got Red Tails on the back of his jersey, and he's looking out onto an airstrip. The next headline reads, Urbana School District. Up for discussion, return of elementary students. This article is written by Jeff D'Alessio and is based out of Urbana. Elementary students could be back in Urbana classrooms on a part-time basis by month's end if the school board signs off tonight on administrators' recommendation. Much like the plan under review in Champaign, the 29-page Modified Hybrid Phase 2 document up for discussion tonight in Urbana calls for a partial return to in-person learning for some students, primarily at the elementary level, at the start of the second quarter. While remote learning in place district-wide since March is working well for a large number of students, administrators note some of our most vulnerable, marginalized students are not engaging in remote learning. Our younger students need us the most, the administrators added. We believe our younger students will learn better physically in the classroom. Two options will be discussed, both of which involve in-person learning for students in grades K through 5 who choose that option from 8:30 to 11 a.m. Wednesdays would be devoted entirely to remote learning and deep cleaning. Should the county's COVID-19 metrics require altering plans, Urbana would pivot back to remote learning immediately. Most middle and high school students, meanwhile, would continue with remote learning, administrators said, citing the extensive planning needed to execute a hybrid schedule at those levels and the start of the semester being a more natural break for coursework. District officials also plan to devote a chunk of tonight's meeting to sharing the results of a survey of students about how remote learning is going from their perspective. The packet for the meeting includes the results of a survey of 485 staff members who were asked about their comfort level in returning to work at the start of the second quarter for a transitional hybrid in-person model. At the district level, 39% expressed some level of comfort, while 61% had some level of discomfort. At the elementary level, it was 37% comfort and 63% discomfort. Again, the next headline reads, Domestic Violence Awareness Month, Accepting Donations for Annual Supply Drive. This article is written by the News Gazette and is based out of Danville. Vermilion County State's Attorney Jacqueline Lacey is partnering with Vermilion County Title for their third annual supply drive to benefit Crosspoint at the Y Domestic Violence and Transitional Shelter. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Donations can be dropped off at Vermilion County Title, the Vermilion County Administration Building, and Crosspoint at the Y. Cleaning products, towels, diapers, personal hygiene items, and the like are needed to support those served by the shelter. I'm Susan Muirhead, and this has been part one of the News Gazette, dated for this date, Tuesday, October 6th, 2020. Thank you very much for listening. As always, it's a pleasure to read with you. I'll be back shortly to resume with part two of the News Gazette, dated for this date. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you have a wonderful day.